My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonitotum, episode 90. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonitotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I have been an independent creator, self-publisher, author, podcaster, songwriter, all the things. Since let's just round it and call it the turn of the century. Also, my day job is helping other creators bring their works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. In this episode of Sonitotum, we have a conversation for you with the romance author Deborah Parmley. As it says in Deborah's biography that you can find over there at deborahparmley.com. That's deborahparmley.com. Deborah believes every day we are alive is a beautiful day. And she likes to give her readers and her story people a story that ends happily. An Air Force veteran's wife, Deborah is most known for writing military romantic suspense. She writes also gritty Western historical romance, 1920s romance, contemporary romance, holiday romance, fairy tale romance, time travel romance, and poetry. In her freelance work, she has done interviews and written travel pieces. And finally, as Deborah Bishop, she writes fantasy, fairy tales for all ages, and children's books. Deborah is married to her high school sweetheart, and after living in 5 states with her husband and 2 sons and living for 23 years just outside Memphis, Tennessee, she and her husband sold everything and moved into a 43-foot motorhome. She now lives in the motorhome with her husband full-time as they travel the U.S. You can see her travels on her Beautiful Day Traveler blog and her Beautiful Day YouTube channel. And once again, you can find all that stuff at deborahparmley.com. You know, this interview was recorded back in January of 2023. And today is July 12th, 2023. It's a Wednesday here at the Lush and Lavish Studios of MWS Media in Southern California. And in the process of listening back to our conversation and editing it and preparing it for you, it really struck me just how it's sort of like a little time capsule of a lot of things that I need to hear and need to think about and need to be reminded of now, 6 months, 7 months later, and perhaps especially 2 days before my 56th birthday. So suffice to say that I got a lot out of the conversation with Deborah Parmley, and I think that you, creative person, dear listener, you will too. So let's get into it. Here is me talking with Deborah Parmley. I usually like to start these shows by asking a couple of basic questions that we can go as deep on as you like. And the first is, what do you create?
I create quite a few things. I write home short stories and novellas and novels. I write in more than one genre and in more than one subgenre. So, for instance, as a romance author, I write military romantic suspense. I write historical Western romance, 1920s romance, fairy tale romance. I've got a futuristic, and the list kind of goes on. And then regular romance, of course, without the suspense, but there's a thread that runs through it all because I like action and adventure in my stories. So it's not totally romance. It's always going to have something else with it. Then as Deborah Bishop, which I just started a year ago, I am writing my non-romance books. So fantasy, fairy tales. Oh, also as Deborah Parmley, because I live in a motorhome full time and we travel the U.S., right now I'm writing a book about our first year on the road, how we sold our house, sold everything, moved into a motorhome full time, took a 109-day trip from Ohio to the California Redwoods and back to Memphis. So I'm multi-genre author for sure.
Why do you create?
I love stories. I've loved stories since before I could read and was constantly begging for another story. Luckily, I had grandparents and parents that would indulge me with that. And also when I was in school, I would make up stories in my head. So when I was able to finally write things down, I started off with poetry and moved from that to short stories and then into the longer forms. But I've always either been reading stories, listening to stories, or writing them my whole life.
So as an adult, have you ever thought about or explored why that is? Why the love for story, and how did it develop into actually creating your own? Plenty of people enjoy stories, but not everybody goes on to create their own.
I think imagination plays a very large role in that, because listening to a story, I would imagine it, I could see it like a movie in my head. So then the same thing would happen when I'm writing. I start to see and hear the characters. I can close my eyes. It's like they're there. And it just unfolds. And I love to write, the actual process of writing. It's not agonizing at all. It's not difficult. It's joyful. So I like the act of writing and creating and being with my imagination in that. There's really nothing like it.
So you've described how it feels, but why do you think that is?
I think I was just born this way. I can't remember a time when I wasn't like this.
Maybe so, yeah. Do you have, you said your parents indulged you about the love of story. Was there maybe a formative influence early on?
I think my grandmother may have been, well, I know she was a very large influence up until I was 9 when she passed. I found out later that she had edited someone's book as just a favor, and her house was full of books and poems. And I mean, reading material was everywhere. Story was everywhere. So yeah. I was surrounded by it when I was there.
This is just what people do.
Yes. And she was there taking care of me while my mother worked full time. So I had that on a continual basis.
Lovely. And you mentioned you started with poetry. How old were you? When do you remember it becoming, this isn't quite right, but there's a transition from this is a form of play, but eventually it becomes, oh, this is something that I am dedicated to, I'm serious about. When do you remember that? Was it with those early poems, or did it come a little later?
It came in stages. I didn't actually write down stories or poems unless I was assigned to in school until I was in high school. Prior to writing anything down, though, my grandmother would say that I was a poet because I played sing-song kind of games when I played. So I was already playing with words before I ever created more substantive things that you could read or look at. And then I got married very young. I married at 18. So I was busy with my children there for a while. Then I went back to college and I went for an English literature degree. And at that point, I knew I wanted to write. So I was writing short stories and poetry. And from there, taking classes about different types of writing, I learned more what I wanted to write, what I was comfortable writing, and then experimented with different types of things. So by the time I had graduated college, I was very firm in that I wanted to write, and I wanted to write for a living, not just as a hobby on the side, on the weekend. It was going to be something I wanted to do. I even had a professor suggest that I not go for an MFA. she was somewhat of a mentor for me. And because she said, you need to spend your time writing instead of studying about writing, just write. Partly because of what my experiences were in college, I was the first student at Marywood College to win first place in the Lambda Iota Tau, which is the English Honor Society. First place in two categories. They'd never had anybody do that. And those went on to the national level. So I was trying to get advice about what to write. At the same time, I had some poems come out in literary journals. And none of the professors would tell me what to write. They said, you write where you're led to write. And being a Gemini and not realizing at the time that it would be okay to write many different things, and also MFA programs and a lot of colleges, they try to direct you one way or another. Here's the poetry arm. Here's the fiction arm. Here's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And that didn't fit me at all. And I think perhaps she knew at the time that that didn't fit me and that I would be best served by just writing where my imagination wanted me to go. So that's the other big turning point.
Let's give that instructor, that professor, some props. What was their name?
Her name was Annette Sloan.
And what was the college you said?
Marywood College. It's in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They've become a university in the meantime. Mm. But I still say Marywood College because that's what my diploma says.
So. That's where you were. Yeah.
Right.
The other thing, too, that strikes me, I've talked to many people, friends and peers, and oftentimes the MFA program in creative writing kind of directs you toward an academic career rather than the actual practice of, and so that's lovely that Annette Sloan was directing you to make things if you can,
can
be, and the other thing is always there, you know, if you've got your degree, you can always teach, but not to become part of that sort of positive feedback loop, that silo of academia.
In hindsight, I don't think I would have fit very well in there because of what I am writing. I mean, I don't believe romance is all that well regarded within that circle. And I like writing stories for fun. Mm-hmm. And I want as many people as possible, of course, to read them and enjoy them. I'm not really writing them for praise or acknowledgement from academia. Those aren't goals for me and never have been. If you would have asked me back then who my target audience was, I would have said the woman on the farm who's tired at the end of the day, who just wants to sit down and read a good story. Mm-hmm. So I think I just wouldn't have fit in that.
The idea of that target audience. And I also want to talk a little bit about the many, 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 many sub genres in the romance sort of super genre. So that person that you imagine when you're writing, that person you're writing to, which I think is always kind of a great exercise. I do that very, very, very consciously with this podcast when I'm doing solo episodes, definitely talking to someone. I mean, this is sort of an overlapping question. It sounds like you were already leaning toward some variation of the romance genre when you were still in college. Is that more or less right?
I didn't realize it was romance, though. I knew I wanted to write, I guess, well, they called it, back then they had a class on it. They called it popular fiction. So it encompassed romance and mystery and Westerns and all the different genres that fall within that. I knew I wanted to write that more than I wanted to write literary. I don't believe I knew exactly what I wrote because I hadn't written enough of it.
Right.
But later, my first short story was published in an anthology titled More Monsters from Memphis. And my short story was a vampire story, Vampire from Memphis. Mm-hmm. And the editor at the time told me I had a lot of romance in the story, and I thought I was writing horror. So there it popped up. And then I wrote my first novel after a challenge at the Ozark Creative Writers event in Arkansas. And Dusty Richards, who was a well-known Western author at the time, ran a contest. If you had not written a novel, he challenged us to write your first novel, make it a Western, and if you win first place, my agent will read the entire manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a big deal back then because they didn't have indie publishing. So
sure.
I jumped on that, started writing a Western, and the more I wrote, the more of a romance it became. And so by the time that was done, it was a blend of Western and romance. I think at that point, it became clear that no matter what I started to write, there would be a romantic element to it. And that's still true today. I can pull it out if I need to, but it's going to try to come in. And the other thing is that I didn't realize I would be writing novels and novellas. I thought I'd be writing short stories because that's what I'd had success with in college.
Mm-hmm.
And that challenge allowed me to look at a novel differently. But before the challenge, I thought that was just too big, too much. I couldn't wrangle that much or wrestle it or whatever. But I started to look at the short stories that were piled up and realized that the amount of pages I put into all those short stories would have equaled a novel had I written one. And with the challenge, I started to learn that form a little better. And I found I really liked it. I think we kind of write our way into learning what we write as we experiment with things. Unless you just know from the get-go what you want to do exactly and do that, I think most of us kind of have to see what's on the page, what's coming out, what are the themes, what are you drawn to. It's hard to have that knowledge at first because you haven't had enough stories to look at and pull from to answer that question.
Now that you've been doing this for a while, do you find the novel, or at least novella and onward formats, and I'm going to say format rather than length because they are structurally very, very different from short stories. Is that just sort of, is that your sweet spot in terms of what you want to accomplish as a storyteller?
Well, it's been interesting because my first novel came out in ebook in 2008 and in print in 2009. And back then, publishers wanted 100,000 words. So you had to hit that mark or they wouldn't look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll never forget reading Dan Brown when he started putting out his books. They were fast paced and mm-hmm. short chapters. And halfway through that first book, I looked at it and went, holy cow, this is going to change everything. And ultimately, it was one of the things that did. Now novellas are very popular and I enjoy writing them. But it's interesting because that's closer to a short story than that 100,000 word novel is, as far as the form goes and the way the story pacing goes. And I think the reason it's easier for me to write novellas these days is because I had so much practice writing short stories before I ever attempted one. Whereas the novels, they take a lot longer and I hadn't written as many of them.
You mentioned the 100,000 word sort of ceiling. I know that the word count expectations for the romance genre are considerably shorter, even in the published world, you know, in the publishing world. You know, you can get away with 55, 60,000 words, partially because of the voracious nature of the romance reader. And I think that still holds true today. And people forget also that many of the things that we consider literary novels, the first things that pop into mind are Heart of Darkness by Conrad and, Old Man in the Sea is another great example.
Oh, yes.
Those are novellas.
Right. They are.
So speaking of, and I think you can speak to this very, very well, because of the number of subgenres you work in, it's no secret and it's a feature, not a bug, that romance has a very set list and group of tropes and expectations that the readers demand. I'm going to stop short of saying it's formulaic, but if we could even say there is a formula, because again, that's not to its detriment. That's not a derogatory statement. It simply is. How have you taken that into consideration with the different genres, the different subgenres, the expectation of the reader, and matching that. How closely do you sort of hold to those things, and how far do you tend to stray away? And have you seen a difference in reader reaction and sales if and when you do stray away from those expectations?
Oh, yes. I've experimented with a lot of things. One thing I used to do, I at one time wrote for 5 small presses. So when you're contracted with the different ones, you can't send everything you write to the one because it's contracted over here. The other type is somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So that got me used to writing in several different things in the same year. And so I could see what was selling where and draw some conclusions from it. It's very true when you see these graphs about what readers are buying. That's very true. That's what they're buying, and they buy what they like to read. So if you can give them something they like to read and they read the first book, they'll read the second. I always say your first book sells your second. That's what you need to focus on. So within each genre, that's the same advice. Certain things will make readers upset. My first book was half Western, half romance. Mm-hmm. I had some deaths in there. They were very upset about that. But the thing is, when I wrote it, I thought I was writing a straight Western. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize I was writing a Western historical romance. I mean, they forgave me and they, you know, went out and bought more books, but they were vocal about that. So I think in a way, people talk about formula, but if we could get apart from talking about publishers, which authors tend to do because trying to meet those expectations, the publishers are in the business to sell books to readers, and the readers are buying what they like to read. So if your reader likes to read a thing, you know, let's not criticize that. Let's say, oh, hey, what about this do they like to read? Mm-hmm. And can I write a little bit of that into my story? Because then the reader will have a good reading experience. And I think that's key. Whatever you're doing in your story, it needs to be a good reading experience, or they won't come back and read another, and they won't enjoy the one they just read. And who would want to do that? So to me, it just makes sense if you're comfortable enough writing something and that's what they like to read to continue to do that. And I think you should actually write what you want to write no matter what. Mm-hmm. But when you start to say, oh, hey, I want somebody to pay their hard-earned money for this book, then you need to meet a few of their expectations because they want to read something that they're going to enjoy. And if they don't enjoy that, well, then that's not going to work well for anyone.
Just to be clear, I'm not criticizing the nature of genre fiction reader expectations. And I agree, if you are looking to sell to a particular market, if that is your deliberate intent, then of course, if somebody wants a blue car, you can't sell them a red one. It's probably becoming a cliche, but I repeat this quote of Orson Welles over and over again, especially on this show, because I love it. It makes sense to me. And that is the absence of limitation is the enemy of art.
Yes.
In part, he's saying, you know, set up yourself some constraints so that you are forced to think past the our brains are lazy. Our brains just want to do the easiest possible thing. So if you set up some constraints, you are forced to, you know, look beyond, to throw out the easy stuff. And that certainly applies to when we try to cleave very closely to the particular air quotes, rules of a genre. And this is something that, you know, I struggle with myself because I have, as someone who cut their teeth reading, sure, a lot of fantastic and speculative stuff. You know, you mentioned Bradbury. I think of him as my spiritual story father, but also recognizing that if I had been thinking in terms of genre when I was a kid, first being exposed to all these different things, just wandering the library and, ooh, that looks interesting, I may have missed out on some things that I didn't know. You know, you don't know what you don't know.
right.
And I'm going to try not to get too high up on the soapbox because I do this all the time. I talk about this all the time about how the structure, especially of Amazon, encourages readers to sort of stay in their lane, because that's gonna sell more books for Amazon, right? You know, if you buy a particular type of book, the next thing you're gonna see, and the next thing, and the next thing, all of these algorithmically driven marketplaces, whether it's music or books or whatever, they're built that way. And I think that's perfectly fine if that's what the reader is looking for and they're not interested in anything else. But I do wonder if it makes it more difficult, you know, like, for example, your Shapeshifter story didn't sell well because it was, I'm assuming, it was being marketed by a small press that was dedicated to a certain audience.
Right.
You know, today, right, with the right keywords, self-published, yeah, probably do all right, you know.
That's true. Yes. You know?
That makes me think also of, you know, you talked about, we touched a little bit on popular fiction versus literature, and I wanted to just briefly get your take on, and this is the $1,000,000 question and the cause of many online battles. What do you think is the difference between so-called literary fiction and so-called popular fiction?
Well, that's an interesting question. I happen to be a huge fan of Dickens, and it's interesting the things that Dickens did in his day that, you know, now we're studying him in college, and yet he was definitely what you would consider a popular fiction author, and he wrote serial fiction, which now that's come back. And it's real interesting to look at that question from this time period, because what has always disturbed me about people in the different genres is when they're not kind to the other authors and the other genres. Mm-hmm. To me, books are like ice cream. Mm-hmm. There's many flavors. I'm glad everyone is enjoying their ice cream. Can we provide all the flavors? So if we provide, like Baskin Robbins, all the flavors so they can choose what they want, they might have more than one they like. They might have one this week, another the next week. None of the ice cream is bad. None of it is better than the other. It's just a different flavor. I think we should just encourage each other to have more ice cream and enjoy it and try to get away from all of that what is better kind of mindset. But back to Dickens for a second, he wrote popular fiction, and I'm using him as an example because his serial fiction would not have continued had it not been so popular. And we would not have all the stories we have today had it not been so popular, and the publishers getting behind him. And I think what he understood very well was to write stories that the readers would enjoy. And that's got to be behind all this. It's got to. I mean, there are plenty of reasons to put a book out. You might want to pass it on to your children or have it on your shelf. But if you want someone else to read it out there that doesn't even know you, you've got to give them a good story. And I think at the root of what we all do, whether it's publishers, editors, agents, authors, we are trying to provide books that we enjoy and that we think others would enjoy. So we actually have more in common than we have differences. It's just different forms, like the ice cream. So divisiveness isn't a good thing. And, you know, being kind and accepting of others is. So it would be great if we could do a little bit more of that. That's my soapbox.
No, and I completely agree. I mean, you know, I'm on record as saying, let's eliminate genre and just allow readers to self-select. But for yourself, what makes the difference between, okay, this is not literature, this is popular fiction?
Well, literature, and I'll say this, it's interesting that the literary camp tends to look down a little bit on popular genres such as mystery, romance, Western, etc.
Oh, I think it works both ways. Yeah.
It works both ways. Yeah, yes.
I hear it from both
and
sides.
And yet the MFA has a tone and voice to it that if you read one of those, you know that's where it came from. If they're not careful, they'll sound too much alike, in the same way as if a popular fiction author is not careful, all their books will sound exactly alike. And people will say all they've done is change the setting for characters, right. You know, so there's a danger there. in writing two.
We're not mentioning Patterson.
But you know, and I'm not saying any of these things are good or bad books. I'm just saying there's a danger in writing too close to that because the originality isn't there. I would say that, and of course, in my mind, my perfect world would be, it would go into the literary category if it did things like Dickens did. The story is so memorable. People can't forget A Christmas Carol. No one that's ever heard it or seen it will forget that story. The characters are memorable. Their names, things they say. Mm-hmm. That's good writing, whatever category it's coming from. Then there are books that make it into the literary category and you look back 10 years ago, it came out and you're like, I've never even heard of that book. And you, and if you do read it, which I do, I read literary fiction, mm-hmm. I'll think, will this stand the test of time? You know, I don't know. Are people reading it because they put it in the category, or are they reading it because someone said, oh, hey, this was a good book?
Yeah.
I'd like to see more of, hey, this was a good book, make it into the literary. I think if that was one of the requirements, then whatever it came from, it would stand the test of time because the others won't. And I'm not sure how to go about anyone would fix that, but and I like reading literary, and there are assumptions people make about people that read it and write it as the same as they do about genre fiction.
Indeed.
And why do we have to choose one side or the other? Maybe it's the Gemini in me, but I refuse to be put in one box with one thing. That does not work for me. You know, I'm going to punch holes in it if you put me in a box. I'm going to reach out to the next thing, so that won't work.
we're definitely not going to solve this problem today, but no. I do like hearing, you know, from authors who either have the experience of a broad writing or reading palette, as it were, or who write, you know, deliberately across several genres, which you mentioned, you're branching out into fantasy and other genres as a pseudonym. And I assume the pseudonym thing is to not dilute the strong brand you've built up with the various romance subgenres.
It's actually for my readers, because if it's a Deborah Parmley story, it's either, well, I've got a poetry anthology out there that came out before I was writing fiction. Those poems I had out there before I wrote fiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing a travel book, and people that meet me as Deborah Parmley. So I'm not going to put that under a different name. So with the exception of those two books, my romances may or may not have adult relationships. It's not erotic romance, but I mean, they may kiss. They might go a little further. They might close the door. It might open a door. It depends on the book. If they pick up that book, they don't want their 15-year-old daughter reading it because it might have something in there, or it's got violence in there, because the military romantic suspense. I've got Navy SEALs. I've got a live shooter in a theater, and the Navy SEAL has to take care of that and stop that. Mm-hmm. That's going to be violent.
Yeah.
So maybe, again, you might not want your 15-year-old reading that, but that's clear because it's under Deborah Parmley.
Yeah.
There's a heroine in peril. There's, you know, bad things happen. There's fight scenes, etc. Deborah Bishop's stories will not have the romance, and I will limit the violence because I want more of an age group to be able to read that. I would like my grandchildren to be able to read that. And I'll be writing children's stories under that name. So, well, it'll help with a lot. It'll help readers. It'll help booksellers and publishers know where to put the books.
Well, and that's what I meant by the brand, you know, the brand is simply expectation. Yeah.
My brand is so difficult. I've had people telling me, you've got to pick one and you should have a name for all these different things. And I said, no, do you know how many names I would have? And I write a lot of different things. And then after I've written them, then I figure out, well, where will this fit?
So let's talk a little bit about the second tent pole of the show. And that is finding success as we each define it. So first of all, in your creative writing life, how do you define success for yourself, and how's it going? Where are you at in relation to that?
Oh, wow. So I used to have two great big goals that I haven't met yet, but I've changed the goals. My two goals were, I wanted to make the New York Times bestseller list, and I wanted a beach house in which to ride in, right on the beach. Well, last summer, we spent 5 months in our motorhome, parked on the Outer Banks in Hatteras, Rodanthe, Hatteras Island. And that's a sandbar. So living on a sandbar, I could walk out the motorhome 5 minutes out the door and I'm on the beach. Mm-hmm. I did that for 5 months. It was wonderful. I also saw two houses fall into the ocean during a storm that shut down Route 12, which is the only way on or off the island. And when I asked a local, well, how will they evacuate us if they need to? She said, oh, honey, you just batten down the hatches. There's no boats running this time. And I went, oh, okay then. So I crossed that off my list. Maybe not such a good idea to have a house right on the beach. Right. So let's rethink that. Maybe take a vacation to the beach house, but not own one. And then what with things happening with another bestseller list, which we don't know whether it'll come back or not, I thought, well, maybe that's not the best goal either. Maybe I need to rethink this whole thing. So this year I have rethought in January, which is a timely question. It's 2023 in January. I said, well, what's my new goal? What is my new goal? My new goal is to write as many of the stories as I can while I am on this earth. Because I'm always getting new ones, and that's going to be a good goal, which will bring other things. Mm-hmm. And the other is to make it possible for as many readers in as many countries as there are possible to read my stories. So those are very different goals, and they will bring other things that will be very abundant. It's a big shift in mindset. It is affecting my stories now, too, because less than a week after rethinking and coming up with new goals, I suddenly had a new story and other story ideas. And I thought, wow, I just opened a floodgate on this that's probably been held back by my old goals limiting me in a way I had no idea they were limiting me.
Mm-hmm. Let's touch on that for a second. So I think it is, and this is something that I've sort of wrestled with myself. The shift, it sounds like for you, was from a tangible, sort of measurable thing.
Yes.
To a process, an aspirational thing. It sounds as though you have shifted away from, to put it really simply, from reaching for something that you don't actually have control of, to something right. that you can at least begin to assert control of, because it's just you that yes. you need to worry about. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. As I said, I'm wrestling with a similar shift. So how have you, or how are you, probably more accurately, how are you doing with moving away from that, like, more, to put it crudely, materialistic end game? Because it can be hard to let go, you know, because there are real world monetary and financial pressures. How successful have you been in kind of moving yourself away from that previous mindset to the present one?
I think it has made me relax more when I write. Mm-hmm. The original goals were very monetarily based. You must reach those monetary goals in order to achieve those two things.
Yeah.
And they're not so much story based. They're money based.
Right.
And there's a big difference there. Let's just say, let's like riding in a corset, taking that corset off to allow more breath, deeper breaths with the writing is allowing me to write a story I wouldn't have been writing that I hadn't even thought of yet. And allowing me to do more with it. There's more potential there. And the irony of the whole thing is I can succeed at those two things and the money will come then. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
kind of, you know. Also, those first two goals, I think some of that came from other people telling me things through the years. You know, mm-hmm. that's how other people judge you as successful. Mm-hmm. Oh, did you make a bestseller list?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've made an Amazon bestseller list in two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote in a couple other authors' Kindle worlds, and I made it in paid categories for my categories. And I've got screenshots that I kept because Amazon's constantly changing.
Of course.
But I did make Amazon bestseller status. And I also made it on free books when I tried doing Kindle Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing with the free books was just because they download them doesn't mean they'll read them.
Right.
Just because they read them doesn't mean they'll review them.
Right.
So those things weren't coming. I had 5,000 downloads on one book and yet not one review. And I went, oh, well, they're just sitting in a Kindle somewhere. Mm-hmm. No one's even gotten around to them yet. Have they even forgotten about it? Will they ever read it? Who knows? And so already I was kind of moving away from seeing that as a goal, having already achieved it and looking at my royalties and going, well, 5,000 books out there, I should be making a little more than this, you know. So that was just the one book. So I think we should not worry so much about what other people tell us is success when it comes to writing, and figure out more closely what success means for us. You also don't want to set a goal that's so high that if you don't achieve it, it brings you sadness or mm-hmm. frustration or those other things. And I'll admit that that has come with those other two goals.
Sure.
And the new ones, I don't have that with these new ones, because I know I can achieve the first one, to put as many stories out there as I possibly can, because I'm pretty driven to write and somewhat prolific. I've usually got about 13 stories started in different stages, mm-hmm. because I don't do writer's block. If I'm writing on story A, and I sit here for 2-3 minutes and I'm stuck, that's it. I'm done. Save, close. I either get up and go for a walk, do something else, and then come back, or I jump to another story. If I've slotted 2 hours to write, and by golly, I'm going to write, well, I'm not going to sit there and waste 5, 10, 15 minutes when I like trying to think of a name and it won't come and you're trying so hard. It's time to stop and do something else. And it's interesting because doing that makes me more prolific, because it's constant flow of creativity instead of it getting slowed down to a crawl.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that first goal is achievable because of the way that I write. And the second one is just a matter of the availability of different vendors to put your book out there.
I'll mention a couple of things, not as a toot my own horn thing, but to emphasize the point you're making about the bestseller status. I can legitimately say that my first novel was the first book in the history of publishing to have an initial release in paperback, ebook, and podcast editions. And for a while there, that was something that was a talking point and was interesting to people and raised a lot of questions and helped sells.
Yes.
A couple of years after that, publishers were coming to me, which was a wonderful, you know, wonderful mm-hmm. experience. I wasn't even soliciting. And a big traditional publisher, an editor with that publisher, you know, basically cold emailed me, and the higher ups there eventually passed. And then a small press that wanted to branch into the genre that my book was marginally part of approached me and another author and, hey, we want to use your books to launch this new imprint.
Nice.
Okay, let's do that. Well, yeah, but wait.
Okay.
And it was nice. It was a lovely ego gratification. You know, I had built that up. And so signed that contract and, you know, we did a little minor revision and new cover art and all the rest. And I insisted on an advance from this small press, which was unusual at the time, because I already kind of knew from 3 years as a self-publisher that probably all the work was going to fall to me. And indeed, and I created a big promotion and did a big thing. And this is where the bestseller part comes in. In 2008, that reissue of that book under that small press hit number 53 on the overall Amazon bestseller list.
Good.
So not in a, well, again, that's neat. That's great.
Yeah,
I've got the screenshot. I've got the screenshot.
Right, right.
But it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I sold a crap ton of books over the course of a few days because I worked like hell to do that, made that chart position, but it still wasn't enough to recoup the very, very minor four-figure advance. And it never did because, you know, and I don't even mention, you know, it's not part of my marketing at all to say Amazon bestseller.
Right. I took it off mine too.
because I mean, it's the classic, well, what have you done for me lately? You know?
Yeah.
You know? And so shifting away to your point, shifting away from those external verifications, those external ego-driven signals to more, it's almost a stoic philosophy, you know, okay, well, what can I control? And everything else, try to release, you know? And I know that you've just recently kind of shifted to this, but I guess that's, again, that's kind of my question is, how's that going? You know, you mentioned that it's freed you up and you know, you've come up with these new story ideas and it's a little freeing in some ways. Is the ghost of the previous thing lingering? Do you ever have to sort of beat it back? Like, no, I'm not going to worry about that right now.
No, not really. I think watching the houses fall in the ocean completely dashed that one. And that's never coming back.
Yeah.
Although I would certainly love to stay in someone else's house for a summer or a month to do some writing. That part I'd love, but you know, I don't need to own the house.
I guess what I'm saying is more the mindset that you've shifted away from. Does that mindset ever kind of?
I think the mindset's totally gone.
That's great.
Because what with having that Amazon bestseller experience and mm-hmm. then of course the other USA Today bestseller going away. That was kind of a tap on the shoulder because by the time I heard that I was already leaning toward it anyway. And I just went, okay, well then we know that that's probably not the best goal to have when doing the other things could bring you to that anyway. And but author ego. Yes, author ego is an interesting thing. It must be managed because not enough ego and you'd never put your book and yourself out there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have a certain amount in order to have the confidence and the push to get out there. But too much of it, and it's insufferable to be in a room with you. So you've got to get that happy medium place where you've got enough that's helping you to put your things out there and having the confidence and believing in your books and your readers mm-hmm. and your publishers, if you have them, but not so much that you're doing things because it's feeding your ego. Those things might not be the best things for your author career or for you personally.
And the rules that we set up for ourselves, those expectations that we set up for ourselves to satisfy the ego can be detrimental to our own work and our own creative life.
Right.
Yeah. Which segues nicely into the third pillar of the show, which is staying healthy and sane in the process of building that creative life. And we've already touched on a lot of this. You know, your shifting of goals is a great example of that. And I'm not pulling us away from that line of thought by any means. But also, I do like to talk about what are some of the deliberate, maybe everyday things, practices, rituals, systems that you have put in place to stay healthy and to keep that good mindset physically and mentally as you're pursuing the art.
I used to write and stay up very, very late, and meeting deadlines for five publishers made that necessary. I would not advise that anyone write for five publishers. That is too many. That's too many deadlines to juggle. I was younger then and pushing hard. The basic facts are if you don't get enough sleep, it will affect your health. Same with drinking enough water, sitting in a chair too long, not eating properly, not exercising. All of those things take a toll on your health. There's no such thing as a cheat day because your body knows you're not cheating and you're affecting it one way or the other. So mm-hmm. you might as well get that whole cheat day idea out of your head. But I had a couple things that were extreme that happened to me that made me stop doing all that. One is I've had pancreatitis twice and been in the hospital 7 days each time. And when you have that, they stop your food and put you on IV. And the first time I had a stomach pump, so I was in pretty bad shape the first time. Mm. The second time it happened, I didn't have to have the stomach pump. They were 2 years apart. I changed the way I eat. I stopped drinking completely. You cannot touch alcohol if you've had that. Mm-hmm. It's deadly. And I started to be a little bit more healthy, but not as healthy as after the second time. But ironically, I was in the hospital, hooked up to the stuff, when I got the news, because I had my phone in there with me, that the Kindle Worlds program was shutting down.
Mm.
Well, I was writing in two authors' Kindle Worlds, and those were putting me on bestseller lists.
Yeah.
And I was pushing hard to meet deadlines. But I'd been put in a position where I couldn't push hard. Not anymore. And that was the second bout with it. So it was like not a tap on the shoulder. That was like a big foghorn blowing. Hey, you've got to get sleep. You've got to drink enough water. You've got to eat healthy things. You know, you can't eat fried foods. You can't drink alcohol. Do smart things, you know. So I came out of there going, wow, okay, readjust. And I did. And that was the last time I had it was in 2016. So, you know, knock on wood, the healthy things I'm doing now prevented me from having that major issue flare up again. But I also am not writing for five publishers, and I'm not staying up till 4 a.m. to meet their deadline. So I have rescheduled books sometimes when I've had to. You know, if you get the flu for a week and you're down and you're not quite done and the book is due, are you going to, the first day you're well, stay up all night to get the book done when you've been sick? No, that's not a choice I'll make anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to put your health first, because if you don't, it'll catch up with you. As far as daily practices, this is a good and a bad thing, that when I'm in a story, I'm in story world. I don't know where I am. I'm not in the room, really. Someone could come up and stand behind me and I wouldn't notice them.
Yeah.
If I have headphones on, you'd have to stand in front of me and wave your hands or something. So the big bottle of water sitting next to my laptop that I should be drinking isn't touched, because right. I don't even know it's there. So now I have to do things like set timers on my phone, because it's really important to hydrate. You don't want to get dehydrated. That's bad for your health. And you need to stand up and stretch and not sit in a chair. You know, they say if you're traveling on an airline or in the car, you should get up every 2 hours and move your legs, get your blood circulation going. And that's true of sitting at a desk as well. And you've got to get up and stretch. And so I make myself set timers, because it's the only way I can do that while in story world. I mean, I can say I'll do it, but it won't happen unless I set a timer.
Right. A lot of people swear by like the Pomodoro method, which maybe you've heard of. And it's really nothing more than a sequence of timers, so that you're X number of minutes on, a much shorter fraction of that off, and then, you know, a set of those, and then a longer break, and then rinse, repeat.
I usually set it for on the hour.
On the hour, yeah.
You know, an hour from now, I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk and I'm going to drink water. If I have to go to the bathroom, whatever, I'm going to walk and do something, and then I'll come back. Even if all I do is walk around and drink my water for a few minutes, just enough to get that circulation going.
Yeah. I discovered years ago that if I was sitting, it was no good for my leg.
It'll affect what does happen with your neck and shoulders too, because we're hunched, and also our hands.
Yeah. So for years now, I've been, most of my day is on my feet. I have a standing desk, and I tend to, I mean, my day job is helping other writers, you know, make things, and, you know, from a technical standpoint, and everything from editing to setting up their mailing list. Basically anything that I've learned, I'm also helping others with. So I'm on my feet in front of the desk doing that most of the day. And then if I'm writing for myself, just as the mental shift, I'll sit down, you know, I'll sit at a different location, you know, even on a different machine, and on a laptop as opposed to the big desktop. But yeah, it when I was sitting all the time, it was not good.
Well, your fascia tightens. I used to work at a yoga studio as receptionist. So that and a car accident I was in, I learned a lot about this sort of thing. So yeah. Fascia tightens and then your muscles tighten. And then pretty soon you can't stretch as far as you used to because you haven't been. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to stretch. And I don't mean like warming up or going for a run kind of stretch. You don't have to do that, but you've got to at least stretch like a cat to get that fascia loosened up.
Yeah.
Even if all you do is stretch and move around like that. Sometimes if I go to conferences, I teach classes. I used to teach one called Yoga at Your Desk. Mm-hmm. I was in a car accident, which totaled my car and a truck hit my passenger side. It shifted my jaw, clavicle, and hip a quarter inch up to the right. Oof. On the right side. And so I went to a chiropractor for a year and I took a job at a yoga studio that came with all the free yoga I could squeeze into my schedule.
Right.
So a year and a half later, I was totally rehabilitated from that. And I learned certain exercises that are really good for your neck because my neck really needed it. And so I was teaching a yoga at your desk class, which I tried to put together a little bit of video to put on my teaching channel. It gets the general idea out there.
Yeah.
And it's free. I mean, people can go and and I'll tell people sometimes, hey, go check out that video I've got over there. It'll give you some good neck stretches and stuff. It's not like taking a yoga class. I'm not a certified yoga instructor. These are just things I know to do for me.
Right.
So you'd, of course, check with your doctor if you were going to do something. But it's important to stretch. If you stay in one position too long, your body will tend to stay there. You know, just wants to stay there. It tightens up like that. So and then you don't want to overdo it and go from doing nothing to, you know, oh, now I'm going to do this exercise thing. And then you go all out and suddenly you feel bad. Well, you know, you didn't get there fast. Let's unwind it the way we wound it, you know. So
this is something that is coming up as a common thread. I mean, in the small sample of, I think you're the ninth or 10th person that I've spoken to in the last 2 weeks. But the wake up call, you know, the accident, the health scare, the sudden job change. It's funny how we need to be hit over the head sometimes, literally,
to
realize these things.
And I think if we don't listen, we get hit over the head a little harder the next time.
Yep, your second pancreatitis. Yeah,
that's
indeed.
It. Yeah.
The sleep, the hydration, obviously the nutrition and day-to-day just flow state is wonderful. Flow state is what we all love and we strive to achieve. But I agree. I've had days where, gosh, why am I so irritable and why can't I focus? And oh, yeah, it's 4 o'clock and I actually haven't eaten. I've been doing all these things, you know, and I've been close to or in that state. But then, of course, you pay for it, you know, and one of the things about flow state too, I think, is that if you're not paying attention to the other, the needs of your body, then it, you know, it's kind of like creating when you're intoxicated, you don't realize how bad the work is getting.
Exactly. Exactly. Your sleep bank is in the negative so bad. You can't figure out why you have writer's block. Hello, go take a nap.
Why can't I focus? Yeah. Right. What's wrong? Why am I so pissed at every tiny thing? Yeah.
Have a 20 minute nap or something.
Right.
That's it.
Over the years that you've been creating, obviously there are, you know, as we've talked about, there are lessons that are learned. There are practices and philosophies and approaches that get refined. Thinking about your creative writing life to date, if you could distill it down to a maxim or a motto or a bumper sticker slogan, a sentence or two that you can look at and say, yeah, that sums it up. What might that be?
Write with your imagination. Write every story you can and don't put it off.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, write with our imagination. Yes, indeed. And write every story that you can. Those are all interweaving, right? They're not putting it off. And I feel like your story, you've had some wake up calls that remind you, you know, to not not put it off. I kind of woefully joke that a few years ago I looked at my rate of production and the count of just novels that I know that are sort of planned in my story worlds that I work in, and did the math. I was like, well, if you keep this up at this rate, you need to live to be 115. And you need to be in perfect health and perfect mental capacity that entire time.
Yeah.
That ain't going to work.
Yeah. Let me tell you about my friend Bob. So I was in a writing critique group working on my first novel, and we were all different genres in there. And Bob had an eye patch, and I would pick him up and drive him to the event because I was younger and could see better. And one day I got in the car. He loved to tell me about the time he flew to Cuba and patched the wing on his plane and all the adventures that he'd love to tell me that story. And I kept saying, Bob, are you going to write that? Yes, I'm going to write that.
We all know where this is going.
Yes, we do. Well, so then one day I picked him up and he got in the car and he said, Deborah, I'm going to ask you never to ask me about that story again. And I just got goosebumps. And I said, why? He said, I have Alzheimer's and I can't remember it.
Oof.
And I think that is the saddest thing I've ever heard another writer say. So if this could be a cautionary tale for everyone listening, I'd like everyone to get that message, because we don't know, you know, how long we have.
That's right.
We could have, I mean, my great grandmother made it to 106. I hope to live that long and write a lot more, but I might not. You never know. So we've got to write them down. And I think something happens if you tell a story too much, the energy of it changes and you get satisfaction out of the telling.
That's right.
So the urge to write it down is not as strong.
It's the same muscle to our stupid brains. It's the same satisfaction. You know, one of my definitions of success is to flip the ratio of what my revenue is from helping other people create to earning from what I create, you know. As someone who pays the bills by helping other people make stuff, which I love, you know, part of my mission is to add to the culture and by helping other people get their stories out there, that's certainly serving that. But boy, you cannot wait. As you say, you know, tell as many stories as possible and do not wait. And it all ties together with the shifting of the goals and that struggle between, that tension between, well, you got to make a living, and you also have to not worry so much about making a living.
Right.
So, yeah. And that discipline piece, which you seem to have found, is certainly part of that. So yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we shouldn't wait for it as much as possible, you know, and this is why I do conversations like this with people like you, is the listeners of Sonatotum are going to hear a lot of these stories where, like, you know, I had this horrible health scare, or I had this, or I had that. And then I got down to it. Well, you know, you don't necessarily have to wait for that.
I think a lot of times people wait till they have time. Right. And the mentoring that I've done, I do that in between things sometimes. They'll say, oh, I don't have time. And I'll say, well, let's examine your day. Or let's just for a week's worth of days, let's examine your day. And I find out that they're watching TV and they're, and they're reading for hours, or they're doing some other, playing on Facebook or whatever the thing is. And I'll think, Oh, you know, and then I'll have to give them their first assignment to get over that. And this is always the same. It doesn't matter what they've been doing. And I'll say, set your egg timer or your phone or whatever you've got for 30 minutes and sit down for 30 minutes. That's the shortest TV show you can watch. Sit down and write for 30 minutes. If it's important, you will make time for it. So you have to decide if the TV show is more important than the writing, you know, because if you're choosing the TV show, you've made it more important. And you've got that egg timer so that I don't have time. I don't know how much time they think they need, but you can get a chunk of writing done in 30 minutes. People do writing sprints all the time. And if you do that and you just go, 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 if you do that enough times, you'll get caught up in it and you'll want to do it.
Of course. Yeah.
And then pretty soon that pattern, the old pattern's broken and the time is suddenly there.
We can absolutely retrain ourselves and prioritize for ourselves. But what, in your experience, what about the external responsibilities, the pressures from loved ones, spouses, children, that sort of thing? We can train ourselves all we like.
Well, life happens. There's so many concepts out there, especially before someone actually gets published. It's kind of like they think it's the magic wand. When I am published, I will, then this will, et cetera. Magical thinking. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you are published, you know, you'll still get the flu. Depending on how long you're doing this career, family members will pass. My dad was on hospice for 8 months. Yep. I could not write. I gave myself permission not to write. There's a time to give yourself permission not to write.
Of course.
When I did come back to writing, that book has not been published yet. I gave it to a developmental editor and I said, okay, here's what was going on then. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of death. Mm-hmm. We'll see if I can fix it. It may have to sit in the drawer. I don't know. But if I can wrangle it back from what that was into a better story, then that's what I'll do. But you have to give yourself permission to write, and you also have to give yourself permission to write things out of you. Because if you've got something in you that you need to write about, whether it's the father on hospice or someone passed or something sad happened, when my dog passed, I went for a very long period without writing.
Mm-hmm.
Until I started writing about missing my dog.
Right.
Sometimes you've got to write the thing you need to get out of you and get it on the page before you can write your story.
Absolutely. I think what I'm saying, though, is how have you addressed, or have you needed to address, the external pressures from other people who might be keeping you, not with ill intention, but who might be keeping you from your practice.
So this is not a life happen thing. This is you're trying to write and things are pulling at you not to.
And whether it's things or people, and none of us live in a vacuum, and some of us have partners, some of us have children. What's been your experience there?
It's important to learn to set boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true with anything. It's vitally important if you're an author. So how important is it to you to get your writing done, to write your story?
Mm-hmm.
If you let somebody else become more important, then your story has become less important.
Right. And how has that been working out for you?
That works pretty well with me. I've learned to be stubborn. I also have no problem telling people I need to write every 4 days. Writing makes me happy. If I have not written in 4 days and we are on day five, unless I have the flu or something huge that's happening to keep me from it, it's best for both of us if I write, because I'm going to start getting cranky.
Yeah. Yeah.
I call it retraining the people around you, you know,
indeed.
And you can do that with children. I've even had my husband look at me and say, "You need to write, don't you?" And I'll say, "Yes,
I do. Yeah, that's excellent.
So sometimes you have to retrain them.
you've set the environment, which is wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know, I just spoke to an author who has completely structured their life around their writing career and have made interpersonal sacrifices because of it. It's something I tell people, clients and in my coaching and that I've spouted on this podcast many times, is no one can tell the story that you can tell.
Exactly.
You have a responsibility to tell those stories, because, you know, whether it's yet another boy meets girl, or, you know, farm boy becomes prince, or whatever it is, no one is going to tell those stories like you can. And allowing other things to, and by other things, it could even be yourself, to prevent you from doing that is irresponsible.
And if you're getting in your own way, you need to ask yourself why.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got to get at the root of why are you getting in your way.
That's right. That's right.
With me, I jump from story to story. So there might be something about the story itself that has me not working on that particular one. So my question's always different. Yeah, so my question can be a little different than that one.
Well, this has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed the talk. I think there's been plenty of value for our listeners in this across a wide variety of things. Is there anything that you wanted to add or circle back on before we part?
I think story is what matters. That's what our goal is, to put out a good story. And as long as you keep focusing on writing your good story, and hopefully the readers will enjoy it. That's the key to everything. And I think writers that are writing are healthier and happier. And just a reminder to take Bob's story into consideration, and hopefully that'll help motivate you to write the story that only you can write in your voice, because you're the only one that could say it that way. And thank you so much for this interview, Matthew. I've really enjoyed this.
I'm so glad. Deborah Parmelee, thank you so much for being on Sonatotum.
And thank you for inviting me, Matthew. It's been fun.
Hey there. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode of Sonatotum, here are three things you can do to help support the show. The first thing, if you haven't already, please subscribe for free to Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick wherever you get your podcasts. Whichever app or platform you use, find that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Second thing, please just take a moment to rate and review Sonatotum, again, wherever you get your podcasts. Rating is quick and easy. 5 stars is very nice. Go ahead and give the show whatever you think the show deserves. If you have just a few minutes more, please let the world know why you enjoy the show, why other people should listen to it and subscribe, by writing a brief review in your own words. Subscribing, rating, and reviewing, that all costs you nothing but time, but they make a big difference for the show, because when people are looking for podcasts on the writing and creative life, Sonatotum is more likely to show up in search results if it has a high rating and some nice reviews. Finally, Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick is made available for free and has no advertising. But it does cost time, resources, and money to produce every single week. If you'd like to go the extra mile and you have the will and the means, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron to offset the cost associated with the show and my other creative endeavors. Not only will you be a member of the Multiversalists community of writers, readers, and creators, you'll receive special access, perks, and exclusive content, the least of which is the uncut, unproduced edition of every episode of Sonatotum. Also, get this, your first 7 days are free. After that free trial, it's just $5 per month. Visit mattselznick.com/b-a-patron to find out more and to start your free trial. That's it. If you do one or two or all three of those things, you'll really be helping the show, and more people like you will discover the Sonatotum mission of helping writers and other creators make stuff, find success, and stay healthy and sane in the process. Thank you. So as always, my friends, I'm very interested to know what you thought about that conversation with Deborah Parmelee. I hope that it was useful to you. Certainly was to me. And I hope you will, of course, check out all of Deborah's stuff over there at deborahparmelee.com. If you do have any feedback for this or any episode of Sonatotum, you can, of course, leave a comment right there in the show notes for this episode, episode 90, at mattselznick.com/sonatotum-090. That's mattselznick.com/sonatotum, sonitotum. 090. You can also just send me an email at matt@mattselznick.com with your thoughts. I reply to every email. If you'd like, you can record a little voice message, maybe on your phone, and email that to me at matt@mattselznick.com. I will endeavor to play that in a future episode of Sonatotum, and we'll have a little time-shifted conversation, as I like to say around here. I would love to thank, and so I'm going to thank, my multiversalist patrons. My multiversalist patrons help make this show possible. They help offset the cost and the energy and the time that goes into making an episode like this. You heard all about it back in the little interstitial pre-recorded bit just after the interview. At least $5 a month gets you access to the uncut, unedited edition of this show, as well as anything else digital that I create for the duration of your patronage. And your first 7 days are free. That's right. There's a trial. So there's really no risk. You can go, as I mentioned, in the interstitial to mattselznick.com/B-A-patron. And those existing patrons are, those beloved multiversalists are, Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. You can find their pictures and, I think in every instance, links to their websites over there at mattselznick.com/B-A-patron. All right, folks, I am recording this in a window of relative quiet before they start tearing up the alley behind my house in a few minutes with a bulldozer. So keeping it short, plus the interview was a good big chunk of time. So I hope you made it all the way through. Hey, you're listening now, so you must have. In 2 weeks, I will be back with another author interview, this time with Teresa Wilhelm Waldoff, who has a great story to tell about a journey of research and being a relatively new writer with a very personal passion project. So a little bit of a different approach than perhaps the folks we've talked to so far. But you know what? Every one of these conversations includes experiences, professional, creative, and life that are going to resonate with you as an independent creator and author yourself. That's it, folks. Thank you so much. See you in 2 weeks. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.